In his new book, Suicide of the West, National Review's Jonah Goldberg talks of what he calls the miracle, the immense and ongoing increase in human wealth, health, freedom, and longevity ushered in during the Enlightenment and Industrial Revolution. At turns sounding like Karl Marx, Joseph Schumpeter, and economist Deirdre McCloskey, Goldberg writes, in a free market, money corrodes caste and class and lubricates social interaction. Capitalism is the most cooperative system ever created for the peaceful improvement of people's lives. It has only a single fatal flaw. It doesn't feel like it. In a wide-ranging conversation with Reason, Goldberg talks about his new book, how his thinking has evolved on a number of culture war issues, and why he can't just admit once and for all that he's becoming a libertarian. Jonah Goldberg, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In Suicide of the West, you talk about the miracle.
Right.
Describe the miracle.
I call it the miracle largely because it's inexplicable. When something hugely providential and wonderful happens that you can't explain, we call it a miracle. And one of the things that I was struck by when I started working on the book was there was this remarkable consensus that for sort of the Deirdre McCloskey thesis, and I'm deeply indebted to her, that for 250,000 years, the average human being everywhere in the world lived on about $3 a day or less, right? And then once and only once in all human history, it starts to change. Unbelievable consensus about this, from the hard left to the hard right. Everyone sort of agrees on those numbers to one extent or another. Right. When it comes to the question of why it happened, all consensus
and
breaks down.
Where it happened, because, I mean, and you go through, and, you know, and I have to say, as a kind of, like, globalist libertarian, it's nice. I mean, like, you know, it used to be that, well, the Industrial Revolution happened, and, like, the Enlightenment, or whatever you want to call it, this massive rise in living standards. Of course it happened in the West, because we speak English in the West, or we're British, or, you know, we have PBS or something.
Right.
And it's, I mean, you talk about, like, it didn't have to happen here.
That's right. So it happened, I argue it happened in England.
Right.
McCloskey makes a good argument that it could have also, you also could sort of say it started in Holland. And every now and then I hear from some Dutch jingoist who says, no, it was Holland, whatever. But I think the better case is to be made for England, but obviously there was cross-pollination, right? But it only happened once, at least in a sustained way. That you could point to the Republic of Venice. You can point to these various moments.
The Czechs had their moment.
That's right.
That, yeah.
But almost always, when things started to go like this, there was this regression back to the mean. The logic of Malthusianism. Something kicked in. I tend to believe it had to do with the powers that be circled the wagons, crushed innovation. You know, the Chinese call back the ships. They kill the steel mills. They kill the printing press. Because innovation was threatening to the powers that be, to the status quo. But for some reason, and I think McCloskey is largely persuasive on this, what causes the miracle isn't some specific public policy or anything like that. It's words. It's language. It's the story we tell ourselves about ourselves. For thousands of years in Western Europe, innovation was considered a sin, the sin of curitas, questioning the established order. And then all of a sudden, innovation from the ground up starts bubbling up, this idea that this sort of Lockean idea, it doesn't come from Locke, but Locke represents it, that the fruits of our labors belong to us, that if you can build a better mousetrap, you should reap the rewards of that. And it has this explosive effect that spreads out across the world. And part of my argument is that there's this very annoying debate about whether it's the Enlightenment or not, right? And I don't think there's any one Enlightenment. The reason I call it the miracle, because it includes all of the quirky weirdness of English culture, which was not necessarily about the Enlightenment.
Right.
But also includes, you know, the convergence of things like the Scientific Revolution, Enlightenment principles, the Industrial Revolution. All of these things converge once and only once. But my point of bringing it up is that it's unnatural. If it were natural, if this was how human beings just automatically self-organize into prosperous communities of rule of law and individual autonomy, it would have occurred a little earlier in the evolutionary record than 250,000 years after we split off from the Neanderthals.
What are the attributes that we need to preserve of the miracle? And then, I mean, the book is Suicide of the West, How the Rebirth of Tribalism, Populism, Nationalism, and Identity Politics is Destroying American Democracy. So I've just given you the list that you wrote at length. But you know, what is the essential insight that needs to be preserved? And then when you say we're committing suicide, is it suicide or is it homicide? I mean, is it a self-death or is it being imposed on us?
The working title for the book for a couple of years was The Tribe of Liberty, and which would have been more conducive to my friends at Reason, probably. And the basic argument that I wanted, that I make, and that I want, that I was sort of centered on, was this idea that we need to rekindle this sort of tribal pre-rational commitment to the institutions of liberty. Because one of the places where I think Deirdre McCloskey falls a little short is her dismissiveness towards the institutional theory of development, right? And that there are institutions, but both in the sort of economic sense of just rules, but also actually physical, you know, organizations, groups, traditions, mm-hmm. that inculcate and civilize us and make us respect and admire and want to preserve liberty. And those things are often taught to us in a pre-rational way, right? They're taught to us when we're born into any family that have a commitment to certain ideas. And we have to be taught those things. And
but it's weird, we have to be taught pre-rational kind of identity. I mean, it becomes complicated really quickly.
It does. Right?
Because the whole point, one of the reasons we were able to get rich, and not just get rich, but I mean rich in the sense of committing to an order where we may not win, right? This is
right.
like part of what's central to both Deirdre's
That's right.
Argument as well as yours, is that, like, you know, businessmen as well as leaders are willing to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to open myself up to an election, either in a marketplace
right.
or whatever, and I might not win. But then, you know, you abstract that out, that's kind of science and rationality. But then you're talking about, you know, how do you have a tribe that is at, like, that is pre-rational, like an identity towards something that, you know, it seems like the pre-rational is always going to be opposed to that.
One of my favorite lines is Hannah Arendt says, every generation Western civilization is invaded by barbarians. We call them children, right? And so we come with all sorts of factory preloaded software
right.
in us, but that software is unchanging over millennia for the most part, right?
right?
So a baby born in Viking age, transported to today,
right.
you raise it in a nice family from New Rochelle, it becomes an orthodontist,
right?
right? But if you take the baby from New Rochelle, send it back, it grows up to be a plunder of the English countryside,
right?
right? So we're born into families. You know, there's this argument, I can't remember the guy who says it, there's this argument that, you know, modernity was born in 11th century England by a nun who basically explains that you can't marry your cousins anymore. And that's how the nuclear family kind of emerges as a fundamental unit of English culture. So I'm a big believer that I do think that the nuclear family...
Obviously, by the way, that's not Rudy Giuliani.
No, that is not. Or yeah. our dear leader president.
Yeah.
And so I do think there are, you know, look, one of the things that binds Hayek, McCloskey, lots of the sort of the more Burkean libertarians is this idea that capitalism depends upon values that it cannot create and cannot restore once lost, right? And so one of the things that's a huge influence on me is Friedrich Hayek's Fatal Conceit, where he has the microcosm and the macrocosm, right? The microcosm is the world of intimate relationships, right? The world, first of all, family, but also friendships, community. And the rules there are not market rules, right?
right?
You know, as I often say, in my family, I'm a communist, right? If you have two kids and one kid is really skilled and talented and the other kid really isn't, you don't say, well, he doesn't get the operation, right?
Are you going to flip and tell us which kid is which?
No.
Okay.
One, I only have
yeah,
one kid.
Okay.
So, but
right.
my point
okay.
is that in the family...
Well, you got rid of the loser.
That,
right?
Well, yeah. he went on ice floor.
Yeah.
But no, my point is that within the family,
yeah.
It really is from each right. according to his ability, each according to right. his need. I don't put price tags on the food yeah. in the fridge and all that. The way what Hayek argues is that it's the microcosm that generates the values, the respect for human rights, the respect for human dignity, the respect for the golden rule, all of these sorts of yeasty cultural ideas that make the macrocosm of the extended order of liberty work.
Right.
And the extended order of liberty, which is the world of contracts, of consumers, of the rule of law, it lowers the threshold to dealing with strangers, right? Because in the state of nature, the way you deal with a stranger is you hit him over the head with a rock.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in the modern world we deal with a stranger is we try to sell him rocks or something else, right?
right?
And so part of my argument, which is one of the constants going back to my first book, Liberal Fascism, is that every kind of totalitarian regime or authoritarian regime is trying to take the values of the microcosm and apply them to the macrocosm. We're all one family, right? We're all, you know, Nazism is tribalism for one race. fascism is tribalism for one country, communism is tribalism one class. It is trying to take those sorts of notions of social solidarity and intimacy of the microcosm and apply them to the macrocosm. And when you do that, you destroy liberty and the rule of law. However, when you take the logic of the macrocosm and you apply it to the microcosm, you destroy the engines of value generation that make that work, right? If you try to turn every family into a business,
right,
it would ruin the family.
Yeah.
And if you try to make a country of 310 million people operate as if the president were our father or our mother, right, it would ruin everything that reason stands for and everything that we stand for.
I mean, you talked about how, like, you know, there's a story that we tell ourselves, and it's kind of, if we tell it long enough and it's a good story and it yields good results, we continue to tell it.
Right.
What are the stories that we're telling ourselves that are different from, you know, when do you date? And I'm struggling to recall in the book, but when do you date the decline or the beginning of the suicide?
Because
this is a slow motion suicide.
Right. And again, a lot of it is all figurative, right?
Yeah.
Because
of course.
Part of my argument, you know, getting back to the Hannah Arendt thing or what Ronald Reagan said is, you know, every generation, we're only one generation away from tyranny because we don't inherit a love for liberty in our blood. We have to be taught it, right? So we've had these struggles many times in our past. You look at the 1930s, you could argue the struggle was worse. It took a different form. The arguments were different, but there was this idea about, you know, communism or statism or fascism, collectivism, whatever you want to call it. Those were live propositions in the 1930s in the West, and they succeeded to take over vast chunks of Europe.
You know, you're talking about the 30s and collectivism. Mm-hmm. Okay, so is that the beginning of the end?
In every generation, there are fuses lit that could lead to the end, and in every generation there are successes in putting out some of the fuses, you know. And so I think that one of the places where this transition is coming from that I've focused on quite a bit is it's not so much, you know, should the government be this big or this big or this big, right? But how is the story we're telling ourselves about ourselves changing? So one of the things I focus on, and it's most acute in higher education, but watch virtually any frickin' award show from, you know, out of Hollywood. You find it there too. You find it in mainstream journalism, is this desire to sort of define all of American history by its sins, right? And I want to teach that stuff. Absolutely want to teach about slavery. I want to teach about the bad things that came with Christopher Columbus, what we did to the Indians. We did some terrible things, right?
You're not saying, like, okay, we have to teach, you know, Christopher Columbus was the greatest guy
in
the world,
absolutely
and this
not.
And that, right. And then, you know, George Washington, cherry trees. I mean, it's a thick history and a recognition of where we fail.
One of the things that drives me absolutely crazy is our tendency, this sort of historicist, Whiggist tendency to compare events in the past against an ideal in the future, right? The American founding has all sorts of problems with it, but it was better than anything that came before it, right? And yet what we want to do is we want to hold up the gold standard of not even today, but an ideal sometime in the utopian future against what they were talking about in 1776. And so, for example, you know, take slavery. You know, slavery was abundantly evil, we know that. And the Founding Fathers' great sin, other than the actual institution of slavery itself, was the hypocrisy about it, right? You know, it's one thing in an absolute monarchy to have slavery. Well, everyone's sort of the king's slave anyway, right? It's another thing when a country is founded on a proposition that says all men are created equal and endowed certain inalienable rights to have slavery, or not to allow women to vote, or all that kind of stuff, right?
But, and then also, and I think you point this out, not, and then the twist on slavery is that the children of slaves are themselves slaves.
That's right.
So it's like we even added like a deeper turn of hypocrisy.
That's right. That is one of the truly great horrors of it, right? The old Roman model was
No man is born a slave.
No man's born a slave, but you can be turned into one, right? But your slave's kids are free, right? And one of the things, I got this largely from Michael Munger, one of the things that the Southerners had to do when that argument was no longer convenient is switch to the old Greek Aristotelian argument, which said that some people are just slaves by nature, right? But the point I'm getting at is that the hypocrisy was this incredible gift. Because you can't be a hypocrite without an ideal, mm-hmm. without principles, right? It's only by, one of the things that hypocrisy does is that it illuminates the principle. And it creates a sort of dialectic process by which you have to examine how
you're
short and
falling
short.
I'm thinking back to your first book. I mean, you're like a total Marxist.
I've become much more dialectical. I have.
I agree with you in the right direction. When do you date then this idea that we stopped focusing on, okay, the imperfections, but we're moving towards an ideal, or we're maybe not. And you have a great line in the book where you write, teleology is an antidote to despair and nihilism, which it absolutely is. And teleology, the idea that we're moving inexorably towards some endpoint. When does this shift happen for you in American culture where we stop saying, okay, you know what, like we're fucked or, you know, we're imperfect, but we're moving towards a better place to we are only always failing our best, you know, the better angels of our nation.
You know, it's an interesting question.
And maybe it doesn't matter, really.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it matters because it's an interesting question. And so even right there, it has some worth to me.
But. Well, and you know, in the 80s, certainly, and I'm thinking back to somebody like William Bennett, he, in one of the greatest kind of sleights of hand, he said it was the 60s and not the 50s. But then if you go back and you look at American kind of cultural history or sociology and whatnot, it was like, no, the 50s is the minute that we got fat and happy after decades of depression and war, like we started going downhill. But so where do you date it, or is it just a consistent strain that is now dominant?
I think it's more that. I think it's more that there are certain arguments that become more appealing when the materials, not to sound more Marxist again, but you know, there's this great exchange between William F. Buckley and Whitaker Chambers after Chambers switches to what he thought was going to be the losing side, right? And he refuses to call himself a conservative because he can't let go of his vestigial Marxism. And so he calls himself a man of the right, but he holds up this thing that he calls the Beaconsfield position, which is named after Benjamin Disraeli, who was the Earl of Beaconsfield. And he basically argues that at the end of the day, the thing that drives history is technology and the means of production, and ideas flow from that. I hate to say it, I'm more sympathetic to that than I used to be.
Yeah, this is Marx.
It's also Carl Hess.
Absolutely. No, that the steam engine gives us democracy.
Right. Marx also says the cotton gin gives us capitalism.
And the feudal system was an outgrowth of the means of production.
Right.
I mean, like the cultural superstructure is based on the economic, you know, base.
Yeah, and so one of the arguments that I would make is that pin in this is that one of the great and glorious things about the American Revolution and the Constitutional Convention is that a lot of those ideas that emerged from the miracle, which let's remember, worked, right? I mean, this bourgeois, mercantile, merchant class ideology made poor people richer. It also made rich people richer. But if you're of a progressive mindset and says the thing you should be concerned about is the status of poor people, this is the only economic system that has actually made people richer, and we should recognize that. And the great thing about the American founding is they wrote this shit down and kind of locked us into it. And because of the cultural stock of the population in the American founding and throughout much of the 19th century, it got instantiated and strengthened in our institutions. And so I do think I would probably say that this starts to really start to unravel, not in the 1960s, not in the 1950s, but really with the rise of the progressive era, where you get all of these major intellectuals who basically are taught from the historicist school in Germany. They come to the United States and they think everything is relative. They think that they completely reject, you know, I don't want to say praxeology, but, you know, the views of the Austrian school and all that kind of stuff. And they say that all cultures
I think I'm falling in love right now. that last time I saw, you know, I used praxeology in a conversation, it was, I think, with myself.
Did you smoke a cigarette afterwards?
Yeah.
And so those ideas long simmered. And so many of the ideas, you know, as you know from my first book, I basically consider the New Deal to be the culmination of the Wilson administration, right? And basically, all of 20th century progressivism is a play on the ideas that I think start essentially William James with the moral equivalent of war, and run straight through where we're gonna be nationalists, but we're not gonna call ourselves nationalistic. We're gonna call ourselves progressives and pragmatic, but we are gonna sort of bend the people to rally together in social solidarity as if we were at war, but without war. And those sort of ideas percolate along. They start taking over the universities. And then the materialist part comes in after World War II, where we get really rich really fast. Yeah. And the problem with that, I like getting rich really fast, and I want to make the world get richer really fast, but the violence that does to establish institutions and customs and norms sets a lot of people adrift. And you get, and this gets me to Schumpeter, you get a mass affluent class of people whose careers and professional outlook are what he calls the new class, where they are incentivized and professionalized to pee on America from a great height and to pee on capitalism from a great height and argue, and, you know, and Schumpeter gets a lot of this stuff from Nietzsche's Genealogy of Morals. They're the priests who want to use the only weapons they have, which are words, concepts, and undermine the system of capitalism and argue for something that empowers them.
And this is, I mean, the genius of Schumpeter, who was, Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, which I think came out in 42. It's through your book. Fantastic read. I mean, it's that...
It's unbelievably prescient.
Marx was right that capitalism would destroy itself, but not because of the immiseration of the working class,
right,
and then they would revolt, but rather... that people get kind of fat and happy, and they tend to, they have nothing but anger and ire towards the system that produces more stockings for factory girls,
right,
than the queens.
Right. Yeah. So you get robber barons,
yeah,
who have lawyers for kids, and the lawyers have spoken, yeah, word poets for,
right,
kids, right?
Yeah.
And what's amazing about this is...
So, I mean, in a way, the suicide of the West is it's kind of like a luxury good, right? It's that,
that's right.
We're finally... We don't have to worry about food. We don't have to worry about even, like... next week's budget.
That's
so
right.
We start to turn on ourselves.
Well, but that's true particularly for the upper classes, right? I mean, this is part of how Marx gets turned on his head. You know, in the Communist Manifesto, it's, right, workers of the world unite, which was idiotic because a working class guy in Milan wasn't going to have a feeling of social solidarity with a working class guy from Kiev, but he might for a fellow, you know, Italian, right? What we're witnessing because of this level of mass, yeah, affluence is... it's the ruling classes of the world that are uniting. I mean, I don't want to go all Steve Bannon because, yeah, I think he's a Stygian force in American life, but it is this, literally, that's what cosmopolitanism, yeah, means, right? And so you get these people who, the globalist class, who have more sense of social connection with somebody across the Atlantic who shares their status than they do with the person who cleans their yard.
So let's talk about this, the way, and you mentioned Bannon, you and National Review, I think to National Review's credit, and like you put it on the line, you were like, fuck Trump. I mean, early on from the right, I mean, like you attacked him and have maintained that while also not becoming delusional. I mean, there's some things that Trump is doing that are good.
Sure.
But so you have Bannon and Trump is nothing if not a cosmopolitan. He's a billionaire, and he hangs out and urinates on mattresses all in every continent, right? Even Antarctica. But these are the guys who are saying, like, you're being, like, how does this play out in a world where the cosmopolitans and the globalists, the rich people, are saying, you, a former factory worker in upper Wisconsin, are being sold a good by globalists? Like, what's going on that they're the ones who are the most tribal now?
Part of the reason why I think we're in the shitty position that we're in is, and this is a point I get from Charles Murray, mm-hmm, is that our elites will not preach what they practice. The top 5%, top 10%, whatever it is, the divorce crisis ended for them 30 years ago, right? Rich people tend to live pretty bourgeois lives. You know, we all know the outliers, right? But, you know, Steve Bannon being one of them. He's just got more layers than one of his ensembles. But most successful people in this country wait till they get as much education, right, as they can, then they get married, then they have kids. Right. And it turns out if you follow that basic bourgeois kind of lifestyle, you're going to be okay.
If you graduate high school without... you know, either fathering or mothering or siring a child, like, you're going to do okay.
You're going to do okay, yeah, right? But, you know, and this is something that Tyler Cowen has written about, Peg has written about, that the bonus, the economic gains from marriage are in some cases greater than and often equal to the gains from going to college. But it's part of the gestalt of sort of the new class not to tell people to get married, right? It's go, you have to go to college. You know, they love talking about going to college, but they feel like it's too judgy to say maybe you should get married. And I think this is one of the examples of how our elites are sort of contemptuous of the values that got them rich, and they're terrified of preaching them to other people. In terms of the Bannon sort of globalist thing, look, I think in the case of Bannon and a lot of these guys, it is difficult to exaggerate the level of cynicism involved in a lot of this. The irony of Donald Trump being the leader of the Family Values Coalition is not lost on me. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that as these other institutions that help civilize barbarians of civil society, of church, of community, of civic association, as those atrophy, a lot of people are retreating to people who only agree with them, and they're also retreating to virtual communities, which are just not as good as real communities. Right. And one of the things that the neuroscientists have sort of demonstrated is that when you retreat out of the real world and go into the Facebook world, you first of all have almost all of your prejudices confirmed, because you're only looking for your car keys where the light is good, right? You're only looking for people who are going to say you're right, but you didn't go far enough, right? And they're turning everybody into assholes. And we're watching politics like it's entertainment. And this is one of the things that Steven Pinker is really good on in how the mind works. Most of your brain doesn't understand you're watching entertainment when you're watching entertainment. You know, when you watch a movie, most of your brain thinks the hero really is running through the shopping mall shooting people or whatever it is, right? There's a little part of your rational brain does, but the part that makes you engaged, that makes you jump out of your seat, all that kind of stuff, that's your brain thinking this stuff is real, not just pixels on a screen. And the problem is when you start watching politics like it's entertainment, you stop actually caring about the policy, and instead you just care about my guy winning and your guy's losing. And you get into this sort of asinine, your tears are delicious kind of stuff, which, look, I've done plenty of that stuff in my life. I there's a place for it, but I never argued that doing bad things or stupid things was justifiable or worthwhile as long as you owned the libs, right? And that's where we are now, where on both sides, both on the right and the left, because we've bought into this sort of tribal understanding that it's just a zero-sum thing, our heroes need to win, their guys need to lose, that we no longer actually care about the functioning of governance.
So, and here's, well, two things. One, do you think Trump is ultimately demystifying this? And I remember when National Review came out against Trump, I was like, you know, it's kind of weird because Trump was espousing, particularly on immigration, essentially what National Review had been preaching for decades, really. You know, that we need to stop the flow of Mexicans and they... You know, they can't be turned into Americans and things like that. And then it's like, oh, my God, like he's the enemy. Do you think he's demystifying that and say, you know, we're coming off the hot news cycle of families being, you know, pulled apart, and, suckling babies being ripped from their mother's breast. On a lot of levels, is Trump the end of this? I mean, because he's showing us what we've been telling ourselves, you know, through our electoral process and through some of our rhetorical excesses. This is what we want.
To a certain extent, I think so. I mean, we can get into the weeds about the immigration positions in National Review versus Donald Trump. No one in National Review liked what he had to say about Judge Curiel, right?
Right. You know, yeah, sure.
A lot of that stuff, right? We all thought the Muslim ban thing was idiotic. But I don't want to say all, but I'm pretty sure all.
At least you did. So
yeah. Well, anyway, that said, you know, my position has long been that Trump is not the author of all of our problems. Right. He's a symptom of our problems, but he's making a lot of those problems much worse, right? I mean, Orwell has this line where he says, a man can feel himself a failure and take to drink and become all the more a failure because he drinks. America can be fucked up and then elect Donald Trump and get more fucked up.
Trump is the effect, not the cause.
That's right.
I mean,
that's
for sure. But then is this, does he also offer us, and in a lot of ways, he's the, he's the end of a long 20th century. I mean, hopefully he's the last baby boomer president. He and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders all hate the gig economy. They hate, right. you know, they hate anything new and different. I mean, he doesn't That's even right. use email, which may help him in the long run, but or at least in the you know in legal status. But
he
like,
likes Twitter.
is he closing out? You know, that world. I mean, by showing what it really is like.
I don't think so. I have a much more dyspeptic and dire interpretation. Yeah. I think what Trump has done is break the blood-brain barrier between politics and entertainment in a way that will not be repaired for a very long time. Yeah. I was saying in 2016, you know, as late as July, that if Tom Hanks or, you know, Oprah or one of those guys parachuted in, they could have probably won the election because everyone hated Hillary and everyone hated Trump. I mean, yeah. I mean, both parties managed to nominate the one candidate that had a chance right. of losing to the other, right? It was a choice between two different crap sandwiches on different kinds yeah. of bread, right?
But it was delicious bread.
It was fantastic bread. It was entertaining bread, yeah. And so I think this, you know, this, I would tell liberals at the time, you know, this is a bigger problem for the left than it is for the right because our bench of celebrities peters out around Scott Baio. You know, I mean, we got Ted Nugent. That's about it, right? And they've got this huge, deep bench. And what Trump has proved is that you can have a completely thumbless grasp on the Constitution. You can have, you can encourage members at your rallies to commit violence against people. You can say the most despicable things. And so long as you're entertaining, and so long as, let's be fair. Trump has this lizard brain genius for, you know, it's like a sci-fi character who manages to project what's going on in his head and make the world bend to it. And so you see Democrats beclowning themselves constantly because they feel they have to operate within the universe of reality show logic. And it really does feel like every year the writers of our reality are just getting more and more desperate and bringing back old characters and doing right. crazy shit. And I think that that's what Trump is doing. And I don't know that you right the ship too quickly.
So if we go with the idea that he's the effect, he's kind of like the terminus, or maybe not. He's just like, you know, we're midway down this road. Mm-hmm. But you talked about the institutions that have kind of lost their cultural power. And this is something, if you look at Gallup or you look at any kind of long-term surveys, the amount of trust and confidence in the government and the various parts of government, but also the private sector, big business, yep. small business, philanthropy, you know.
Basically everything except the military and occasionally cops.
Right, and that those can vary, right? Yeah. And it's clear that people like the individuals, but they, you know, nobody is a fan of American foreign policy.
Right. Small business does okay. Military does pretty good. Right. Cops are just above water.
What do we do? You know, what are the ways? And you were saying earlier, like, okay, you know, like we lose that confidence, we mm-hmm. lose the trust, and that's it. It's gone. Is there a teleology that doesn't lead to? You know, you wrote it's an antidote to despair and nihilism. What are the ways that, and maybe it's not teleology, but like how do we reinvest institutions or create new ones that right. are actually worthy of our trust and confidence? Because it is true, you know, starting certainly, you know, and it's easy reasons in its 50th year, we started in 1968. Like you, if you start from 1968, the government has only been lying to us more about big things and small things, whether right. it was Vietnam and why we got in, to surveillance in the 70s, et cetera, like, you know, where it's incompetence. How do we reinvest these institutions with something like trust and confidence that they actually
right.
deserve?
So Nick, you and I go back to at least 20 years, right? We've been on many panels talking about conservatism versus yeah. libertarianism, right? And I've never been on one of these panels, I don't think, where, you know, we're talking about where do we have shared agenda, where right, do we yeah. differ, all that kind of stuff. And sometimes they're hostile, sometimes they're not. Sometimes we pregame too much, whatever. There's always some 21-year-old punk smartass kid who during the Q&A says, all this is very interesting, but isn't it true that if we could just go back to the federalist structure mm-hmm. that the founders envisioned where local communities had more power over their own lives, wouldn't that sort of solve most of these disagreements? Because it's only when you have a national idea when you're when you have a one nation politics right. and everyone wants to impose their
you
values.
Can't exit. I mean,
right. Like there's no to, right to exit.
Yeah,
to.
The, like in a Hirschman, Albert Hirschman thing. Yeah. You there. Where are you going to go?
That's right. And there's not a lot of policy prescription in the yeah. book. But one of the things I think that screams out from it is just simply this idea of pushing as much power down to the most local level possible. I think some of the paranoia about globalists is bullshit. Mm-hmm. I think some of it is totally fair. And some of it is wrong, but understandable, right? And you have to take these complaints on a case-by-case basis. But one thing that's indisputable is there is a widespread view that either Washington or some other powers that be right. are making too many decisions about our own lives. And if you push power down to the most local level possible, you get all of these benefits. First of all, you still have mistakes. You still have communities doing stupid things, right? You can't bring back slavery. You can't bring back Jim Crow. We amended the constitutions. We had a civil war. That's right. done, right? It's a settled question. But if one community wants to, you know, ban stinky cheese, let them. But why does the FDA have to do it, right? And you push these things down to the most local level possible. One of the benefits you get is that people know who the powers that be are. They know their names. They see them at the grocery store. They see them at their kids' events. And it gives you a sense of you know who's accountable. Moreover, you can still have culture war fights, but the winners have to look the losers in the eye the next day. And that breeds a certain sense of humility. It breeds a certain sense of live to fight another day. Instead what we have is these national coalitions, these tribal idiotic coalitions that want to impose one way of living for the entire country.
So let me, you mentioned Hannah Arendt a uh-huh. bit, and, is that what the Trump voter, and it's not, I don't think the Trump voter is like the problem in America necessarily, but are they, do they want to have responsibility for their lives? Because you're right, on a certain level, it's clear like global trade policy changes things and it changes the economy and things like that. But I've lived, at least half time for 20 years in a small town. And I don't, on a certain level, I like coming to Washington or New York because I don't have to look the people who are running my life in yeah. the eye. There's an anonymity there and there's a freedom.
I remember the column got you in a lot of trouble like 15 years ago on this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
City air makes you free.
Yeah. is that what people, is the American, again, using these ridiculous abstractions, are they suffering from a lack of responsibility for their lives, or are they actually running towards, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden or whoever, they're running from, it's an escape from freedom, to use like Eric Fromm or something.
No, I think that's exactly right. I have no problem giving the people their fair share of blame, right? The Democrats are very good at this, and they've been doing it for far longer. This promise that the government can love you, right? That the government can take care of you. That's the Life of Julia bullshit, right? That's mm-hmm. the opening sentence from the Democratic Convention in 2012, which said, the government is the one thing we all belong to, right? Which is
terrifying,
creepy, right?
Like a million levels.
But the people who hear that don't hear, that. They hear belong to, feel like they're part mm-hmm. of, right? That's the politics of meaning stuff that Hillary Clinton used to talk about. And what happens when you feel powerless in your own alienated, deracinated, little corner of suburban America where you don't have many social connections or the inner city, right? Yeah. You don't lose what Robert Nisbet called the quest for community. You just start looking elsewhere for it. And your gaze, since you can't find it in the near ground, your gaze looks to it in the far ground, you start looking to Washington. And the government is the one thing we all belong to line, I'm sure was focus grouped to death. And there are an enormous number of people who feel like they want to belong to something.
Conservatives and liberals or whatever. So, how do you grow and you say, okay, we push power down, political power, say, down to the lowest level possible. That's all well and good. But how do you, teleology is an antidote to despair and nihilism and also group belonging. Like
right.
how, on a basic level, like how does that play out in a way that does not immediately turn to the worst kinds of tribal instincts that you document in the book and that you say are destroying America, I mean, or that are is part of the suicide. What is the positive way of local belonging, as well as kind of also understanding, you know, that you can belong to, this is the thing about Trump that it's always driven me mad, is the idea that, like, yeah, I grew up in Middletown, New Jersey. I love Middletown, New Jersey, and I also want to be a rootless cosmopolitan. Mm-hmm. I don't see any distinction between being a citizen of the world and some, you know, jerk who grew up in New Jersey. How do you create that person who is not a bully, who is not a tribe member, who mm-hmm. is like, okay, you know what? Jonah Goldberg and Nick Gillespie, we're basically, we were born in New York, but you're Jewish and I'm Irish and mm-hmm. Italian, so we have to fucking hate each other. Like, you know, how do you do that? What are the institutions, and if it's the stories we're telling ourselves in higher education and then peeling it back towards K through 12 or whatever,
right?
How do we tell those stories and how do we create those associations?
Okay, so the other person I'm deeply indebted to is Douglas North, who is mm-hmm. pure institution yeah. guy, right? And also
Nobel laureate,
and also Ernest Gellner, right? And so Ernest Gellner is this historian and philosopher, sort of anthropologist guy. And one of the things that he argues is that prior to modernity, right, 1700s, right. whatever, right, all of our identities were overlapped on each other. When you were in the tribe, I mean, people don't know how fundamentally fascist are. The state of nature was for humanity. We grew up in a little tribe, a little platoon, a little troop, whatever you want to call it, and all meaning was within the tribe. Nothing was without the tribe, right? We were all essentially kin. We were all working towards a common good. We were all dedicated to a cause larger than ourselves. In effect, we worshipped ourselves. We deified ourselves. Mm-hmm. So so Gellner makes this point: is like for pre-modern man, when he looked at a tree. He saw a tree that was a source of fuel. He saw a tree that was a source of shade. He saw a tree that was maybe a spirit that he worshipped. And all of these things were intertwined and bundled together. And what modernity comes along and does is it starts dividing up meaning. And it says, no, the tree is just this and not these other things. And so one of the things that I think is the antidote to the problems that we have, and I think that the problems that we have are best identified as identity politics, but mm-hmm. which is just in different forms, is this idea of singular meaning, that all you need to know about me is Jewish guy, right?
Right.
Even though I'm a pretty weak tea Jew, right? Mm-hmm. Or all you need to know about a black person is that they're black. It doesn't matter whether they have a PhD or they're male or female or they're Christian or Muslim. I can reduce all of them into this narrow classification. And one of the great things about the sort of the miracle liberal democratic capitalism, whatever you want to do, whatever you want to call it, is it allows us to have a multitude of identities where we have allegiances to different institutions, but they don't wholly define us. And they allow us to exit one and go into another, try on one, leave that one. The problem with the identity politics mindset is it says, I can reduce someone to a singular thing. And when you do that, you sort of flip the switch of the tribal mind and say, so anybody who isn't me is the enemy, because that's how we're wired. And so what you want to do, and one of the reasons why, you know, the Douglas North thesis is one of the reasons why modernity emerges, is that you got enough institutions that elites would cycle through, that they had a sympathetic imagination to institutions that they didn't necessarily belong to at a moment, and they understood that the system depended upon allowing winners to win, even if it was not, in the moment, good for them. We're losing that. And one of the reasons why I think it's this identity politics mindset, which breaks my heart, is getting more and more popular on the right, and has been instantiated on the left for a very long time, is that we are teaching people that they can't assimilate, that they can't break out of the iron cage of their identity. Look.
They can't mongrelize and hybridize. Here, can I just ask you point blank?
Sure.
Are you going to come out as a libertarian right now? Because what you're talking about is the past 50 years of Reason Magazine,
sure.
of the idea of, you know, and obviously conservatives. And I think one of our first kind of tussles was over... and I had a somewhat pedantic reading of Hayek's Why I'm Not a Conservative. Uh-huh. But it is true that conservatives trail. I mean, that's the idea, that they act as an anchor,
mm-hmm.
And that societies need to be dragged in a particular direction. And one of the functions of conservatism, I think, is to say, okay, let's slow down a little bit, because we don't know, from a Hayekian point of view, we don't know where we're going. And it might be the French Revolution, it might be the American Revolution.
Right.
But I mean, what you're saying, this is so fundamentally libertarian, even to the extent that you're quoting Deirdre McCloskey, who is, you know, used to be Donald McCloskey.
Sure. Yeah.
And National Review and conservatives more broadly, you know, and I'm not saying you specifically, but, you know, are like, no, you know, people who are transgender are mentally ill. Why? What could we possibly learn from them? And you now are talking about overlapping identities and a movement towards freedom and self-definition, mongrelization versus purity.
Mm-hmm.
So will you come out as a libertarian today on Reason TV?
I will put you in and you
can run with Bill Weld for president,
I will not. Not right now. Although, look, I mean, but we're talking about multiplicity of identities. You know, William F. Buckley wrote a book called, you know, Confessions of a Libertarian Journalist.
I think he was just trying to sell copies. Yeah, no, I agree.
My point is that you know, there are many things about which I am a libertarian on.
Right.
And there are some things on which I'm a conservative on. And I have never understood this indictment of conservatism in the way you phrase it from Hayek of... being dragged along. There is a role to be played for being the person to sort of say, hey, wait a minute, right? I mean, I've argued for 25 years that no meeting of policymakers should ever gather or consider a question without a libertarian in the room.
Right.
Libertarian will also often be wrong, but the libertarian will always ask the first question, should we do anything at all? And you get so much groupthink in policymaking shops where they just assume, of course, we got to just do something, right? And the libertarian says, well, wait a second, maybe, you know, the system itself can fix this. And that's, I think, also a very conservative position. I will say, since you brought it up, and this is an old, tongue war between us, Hayek's Why I'm Not a Conservative is talking about blood and soil conservatives in Europe. He's, you know, like, demised in these guys.
I agree that
blood and soil bullshit is seeping into aspects on the right in ways that really dismay me. But he said that in America is the only place in the world where you can call yourself a conservative and still be a defender of liberty, because what we're trying to conserve and defend are the ideals of a classically liberal revolution. And so I've always thought that conservatism, the fusionist conservatism, was a cousin of the libertarians. And I will point this out. I don't know if you saw it, but I wrote a piece for the 65th anniversary issue of National Review last year, 2 years ago? I guess it was 3 years ago. It was founded in 55.
Right.
I was assigned or self-assigned the article of who lost the libertarians, because so many of you guys were going the sort of libertarian way, right? And getting more,
not the smart ones.
With the state forcing the baker to make the cake, all that stuff. And as I started thinking about it and reading about it, I decided, you know, that frames it completely wrong, because in reality, the libertarians are a much older tradition than the conservatives. Hmm. And modern American conservatism is arguably the youngest significant ideological phenomenon in American politics. I mean, socialism is much older, obviously. Libertarianism goes back to, you know, Spencer or Bastiat. I mean, you go way back, right? Modern American conservatism basically begins after World War II. I mean, even the old right doesn't look a lot like modern conservatism or even modern libertarianism.
Well, we're going to leave it there. And I feel like we've made some real headway that libertarians always used to be considered the punk younger brother of conservatives. And now we're the cousin and maybe the forefather.
Yeah, but yeah, maybe.
We have been talking with Jonah Goldberg. His latest book is Suicide of the West. Jonah, thanks for talking.
It was great. Thank you for having me.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.